Hello, this is Atah Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, March 31st, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page, Recreation, Garfield Park, Building Wall, and Building Players. New park attraction to promote teamwork and develop sports skills. Well, and really what it is just a major photo dump of some color photos here. The interactive ball wall is installed at the Garfield Park Playground in Decatur on Wednesday, March 25th. According to the Decatur Park District site, the illuminated LED panels are designed to promote teamwork and develop the skills used in football, soccer, and other sports. And let's see, it looks like basically a overhead garage door, but instead of the solid panels, it looks like glass panels instead in the center. And then on the sides are some strong-looking metal structures as supports. And there's one, two, three, four people supervising its installation, being mounted and installed in the ground. Let's see, next photo here. An interactive ball wall is set into place at the Garfield Park Playground in Decatur on Wednesday, March 25th. And from this side, it looks like the LED screens that the work team is installing. Joseph Ressler, Photos, Herald and Review. And on the front page, Supreme Court justices to hear birthright case. Suit in high court hits close to home for an immigrant mother. This article is by Mark Sherman, Associated Press, Washington. One of the first things an Argentine emigre did after her son was born in Florida last year was get him a U.S. passport. She saw the passport as tangible evidence that he's an American. But now people like her are in a legal fight over President Donald Trump's executive order that would deny U.S. citizenship to children born in the United States to people who are in the country illegally or temporarily. It's funny because I actually booked him for his passport application appointment even before he was born, the 28-year-old woman said, as her now 7-month-old son napped nearby. She spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity, insisted upon by her lawyers out of fear of possible retribution by the Republican administration if she were publicly identified. I would say that I am definitely relieved that at least he is protected, she said. The Supreme Court will hear arguments on Wednesday over whether Trump's order, signed on January 20th, 2025, his first day back in office, comports with the post-Civil War 14th Amendment and an 86-year-old federal law that is widely understood to make citizens of everyone born in the country, with narrow exceptions for the children of foreign diplomats and invading armies. Every court to have considered the issue found the order to be illegal and prevented it from taking effect. The call to repeal birthright citizenship is part of the Trump administration's broader crackdown on immigrants that has included stepped-up deportations, drastic reductions in the number of refugees allowed into the U.S., suspension of asylum at the border, and stripping temporary legal protections from people fleeing political and economic instability. The case presents another test for a high court that has been allowed or that has allowed some anti-immigration efforts to continue, even after lower courts had blocked them. The case before the court comes from New Hampshire, where U.S. District Judge Joseph N. LaPlante ruled that the order likely violates both the Constitution and federal law. Constitution versus Executive Order. The first sentence of the 14th Amendment, the Citizenship Clause, makes citizens of, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, unquote. The case turns on the meaning of the final phrase about jurisdiction, which was also used in citizenship laws enacted in 1940 and 1952. Trump's view, asserted in the order titled Protecting the Meaning and Value of American Citizenship and backed by some conservative legal scholars, is that people here illegally or temporarily are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and therefore their U.S.-born children are not entitled to citizenship. The court should use the case to set straight long-enduring misconceptions about the Constitution's meaning, Solicitor General D. John Sauer wrote. In that regard, Sauer likened the case to the seminal 1954 decision in Brown v. Board of Education, which outlawed segregation in public schools, and the landmark 2008 Heller case, which declared that people have a constitutional right to keep guns for self-defense. Last year, Justice Sonia Sotomayor called the Trump administration's effort to defend the order an impossible task in light of the Constitution's text, history, this court's precedents, federal law, and executive branch practice. Sotomayor was joined by the other two liberal justices in a dissent from a decision by the court's six conservative justices that used an earlier round of the birthright citizenship dispute to limit the use of nationwide injunctions by federal judges. Challenging Trump, the pregnant mothers and their advocates challenging the order are as well as lower court judges who blocked it say the Trump administration's argument lacks merit. We have the President of the United States trying to radically reinterpret the definition of American citizenship, said Cecilia Wang, the American Civil Liberties Union legal director who will face off against Sauer on Wednesday. More than one quarter of a million babies born in the United States each year would be affected by the executive order, according to research by the Migration Policy Institute and Pennsylvania State University's Population Research Institute. While Trump largely focused on illegal immigration in his rhetoric and actions, the birthright restrictions also would apply to people who are legally in the United States, including students and applicants for green cards or permanent resident status. The most beautiful thing, the woman from Argentina said she came to the U.S. in 2016 on a visa to attend college and since applied for a green card. She described a moment of panic after the court's June ruling when it was at least possible that the restrictions could take effect, particularly in states such as Florida, that didn't challenge Trump's order. Lower court rulings over the summer ensured the order remained on hold and set up current Supreme Court case. On top of the predictable worries of a first-time mother, she said, I never thought that, you know, so close to the end of my pregnancy, that I would have to be even thinking about the executive order and how it would have impacted my baby. She has not reconsidered her decision to come to the United States or her desire to stay, she said, as her son stirred. And so nothing that happens politically or otherwise would have changed my views of the country. I mean, because it gave me the most beautiful thing I have today, which is my family, she said. Well, while we're on the local and nation page, A3, alleged swordsman jailed police, defendant wielded blade in office and assaulted worker. This article is by Tony Reed, Decatur. And I will start by saying booking photo, it's quite an interesting photo as well. The only way I can describe it. A Decatur man armed with a homemade sword is accused of walking into a financial planner's office and terrorizing a 43-year-old woman who was working alone in the building. A sworn affidavit said the sobbing victim told police that Israel E. Lattimore entered the office on West Southside Drive, pointed his makeshift weapon at her, and in between talking nonsense said, "You have to come with me." The woman kept telling the 42-year-old Lattimore he had to leave while hitting a button that triggered a silent panic holdup alarm. She stated that Israel was also holding what appeared to be a black-tied electrical cord in his other hand, which he was swinging around and whipping the doors and walls with, also causing the woman to feel as if she could not leave without receiving a battery, said Officer Curtis Kirk, who signed the affidavit. She explained that Israel's behavior and her fear caused her to push the panic alarm two times. She was visibly upset, trembling, and actively crying in fear of Israel. Kirk noted that the victim had to endure her encounter with Lattimore for some 24 long minutes. The officer said the defendant had entered the office at 10:19 a.m. on March 20th, and police, tied up with heavy call volume, didn't arrive until 10:45 a.m. Lattimore had been walking out as officers arrived, but they already had a pretty good idea whom they would be dealing with. Due to several other calls for service with Israel this same day in the same area where other businesses were calling in about him trespassing, Kirk added. He described Lattimore's weapon as being fashioned from several sticks attached to a handle equipped with what appeared to be a sharp foreign object which resembled the blade of a knife. The officer said Lattimore just stared at officers while they questioned him about his behavior. During the officer's interaction with Israel, he called the object with the blade a sword and a weapon, Kirk said. Lattimore appeared March 23rd in Macon County Circuit Court and was arraigned on charges accusing him of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and aggravated unlawful restraint. He has also been charged with burglary. Judge Jack Kiley told the defendant he was too dangerous to be allowed pretrial release and ordered him held in Macon County Jail. Good. Lattimore will be back in court for an April 1st preliminary hearing when he will enter formal pleas. Cops gunfire strikes house. Tony Reed, Decatur. Police said a Decatur woman came home to find a nasty surprise awaited her in the living room. It had been damaged by two bullets shot into her residence. Lieutenant John Quell with the Decatur Police Department said the 66-year-old woman discovered the damage Sunday morning after being away for some time. She called us and advised she had located a bullet hole in her house, Quell said, speaking Monday. We discovered two bullet defects in the house entering the living room of the residence. One of them passed through a TV and another passed through the wall before coming to a stop in a closet door in the hallway. Quell said the woman had no idea why her home would be targeted with gunfire. Reports of fight lead to gunman's arrest. Tony Reed, Decatur patrol officers responding to reports of a fight involving an armed man outside a Decatur apartment complex Sunday morning ended up making an arrest, but it's not clear if this was the suspect involved in the confrontation. Lieutenant John Quell with the Decatur Police Department said the 21-year-old man was seen walking at a fast rate northbound as officers arrived outside North Portage Place around 11:30 a.m. We discovered the person we got out with was armed with a Glock handgun in his coat, Quell added. He had a valid FOID card, but he did not possess a concealed carry license. Quell said the 911 calls had described an armed man involved in a fight, but speaking Monday, the officer said it wasn't established if the person taken into custody was in fact the suspect. The arrested man was booked on a preliminary charge of the unlawful use of a weapon. All preliminary charges are subject to review by the Office of the State's Attorney. And this next story has been making the rounds. I've briefly read about it, but I'll read it here. Nestle, 413,000 Kit Kat bars stolen. Associated Press, Geneva. Swiss food giant Nestle says about 12 tons or 413,793,000 candy bars of its Kit Kat chocolate brand were stolen after leaving its production site in Italy last week for Poland. The company based in Vevey, Switzerland, said in a statement that the vehicle and its load are still nowhere to be found. The shipment of the crunchy bars made of waffles covered with chocolate disappeared while en route between production and distribution locations. The chocolate bars were to be distributed throughout Europe. The missing candy bars could enter unofficial sales channels across European markets, the company said. It's noted, if that happens, all products can be traced using the unique batch code assigned to individual bars. A spokesperson for Kit Kat said consumers, retailers, and wholesalers would be able to identify if a product is part of the stolen shipment by scanning the on-pack batch numbers. If a match is found, the scanner will be given clear instructions on how to alert the company, which then will share the evidence appropriately. Whilst we appreciate the criminal's exceptional taste, the fact remains that cargo theft is an escalating issue for businesses of all size, KitKat said in a statement. With more sophisticated schemes being deployed on a regular basis, we have chosen to go public with our own experiences in the hope that it raises awareness of an increasingly common criminal trend, the statement said. And just looking at the photo is making me hungry for a KitKat. It's a pack of KitKat opened, the four bars shown there, and it looks like some of it has melted a little bit. And KitKat chocolate bar is seen in Rugby, England. Martin Cleaver, Associated Press, photo credit. From the State House, also the local page, but going back to A2, suburban voter turnout shifts in primary election. And this is by Rich Miller. Rich Miller publishes Capital Facts, a daily political newsletter, and capitalfacts.com. The trend in special elections around the country for the past several months has shown spiking Democratic voter turnout and tanking Republican turnout. And some preliminary primary elections results from earlier this month show the same trend here. What follows is a quick look at governor's race turnout in the state's five most populous counties. Not all votes were counted when I wrote this, so the numbers are accurate as of early March 27th, but the final count will be very close to what I have here. Also, I'm not saying that these results are necessarily predictive of the November election. Things change in politics, and sometimes folks cross over to cast votes in competitive local elections and go back to where they were in the general. But the primary turnout numbers have been a broad sign of things to come for quite a while, particularly in the suburbs where we are looking today. The Republican Party has moved far to the other side of social issues important to suburban voters, and President Donald Trump's unpopularity has been further driving that point home. In DuPage County, the preliminary number of Republicans casting ballots for governor fell almost 32% compared to 4 years ago. The DuPage Republicans' drop-off has been steady for years, coinciding with the party's ever-shrinking success in the general election. Last week's preliminary primary turnout in the former Republican bastion is about 49% below 2014, the last year the state elected a Republican governor. Democratic turnout in DuPage, on the other hand, is so far up a whopping 45% compared to 4 years ago. Democratic primary turnout has greatly increased in the country since 2014, which was a horrible year for Democratic turnout throughout the state. That year was President Barack Obama's second midterm, and Governor Pat Quinn went on to lose to Bruce Rauner in the general. DuPage Democratic turnout in the governor's race this year is up 586%. In parentheses, it says that's not a typo from 2014, and unlike some other jurisdictions, DuPage Democratic turnout was significantly higher this spring, 25%, than in the primary held during President Donald Trump's first midterm election. Needless to say, those numbers cannot be providing any comfort to the shrinking number of Republican legislators and local officials who represent part or all of that county. The same goes for Lake County, where Republican primary gubernatorial turnout has collapsed by more than 48% compared to 4 years ago, while Democratic turnout has risen by more than 27%. Lake is another suburban county with a disappearing general election GOP. Republican primary turnout in Lake has dropped every 4 years since 2010, and the preliminary numbers show that 59% fewer Republicans cast ballots for governor last week than in 2010. Lake County Democratic primary turnout so far is slightly above the previous record number recorded in 2018, and it's up 501% compared to the party's very bad year in 2014. Will County's Republican primary vote for governor has so far dropped more than 33% compared to 4 years ago, while Democratic turnout has increased by about 33%. This year's Democratic primary turnout in Will County is slightly down from Trump's second midterm in 2018, but it's up 282% from Obama's miserable second midterm. Will's Republican turnout, as measured here by votes for governor, is down 31% from 2014. Kane County has been trending Democratic ever since President Trump's first midterm in 2018, And even though about 4,000 more people voted for Republican gubernatorial candidates in 2022 than those who voted Democratic, Governor Pritzker went on to win that county in November by 10 points. It's a good reason to note again why this measurement isn't always an accurate predictor. Aurora Mayor Richard Ervin was running for governor as a Republican that year, which likely explains the anomaly. This year, preliminary numbers show that more than twice as many Democrats voted for an unopposed governor versus those who voted in the contested Republican gubernatorial race, 46,000 to not quite 23,000. Kane Republican votes fell by 26% versus 2022. Democratic votes rose by a gigantic 71%. Suburban Cook County long ago slipped away from significant Republican influence. Republican primary votes for governor are so far 33% below 2022, while Democratic turnout is up 41%. The suburban Cook Republican primary gubernatorial vote is down 48% from its most recent high watermark in 2014. Again, this is not a prediction, but legislative Republicans are right to be afraid of another suburban wipeout. Russell Dickerson to headline 95Q show. This article's by Valerie Wells, Decatur. Russell Dickerson will headline this year's 95Q Listener Appreciation Concert at the Devon Lakeshore Amphitheater. The concert will take place on Sunday, September 6th. It is not part of the season ticket package. Tickets will go on sale 10 a.m. Thursday, April 2nd, with a price range of $69 to $39. Dickerson has released 4 albums and has had 5 number one hits. Yours, Blue Tacoma, Every Little Thing, Love You Like I Used To, and Happen to Me. Born in Union City, Tennessee, the singer-songwriter is often inspired by his happy home life with a rise that includes 3 billion career streams, industry-wide accolades, and a solid reputation for lyrical brilliance, rooted in feel-good reflection and paired a good-natured grin. His showmanship has been described as fiery, and his 2025 tour, WrestleMania, was sold out. His most recent album is Famous Back Home and was released in August. It's an interesting-looking article from A6, the State and Nation page. Colleges turn to oral exams to combat AI. This article's by Jocelyn Gecker, Associated Press. The assignment involves no laptop, no chatbot, and no technology of any kind. In fact, there's no pen or paper either. Instead, students in Chris Schaefer's biomedical engineering class at Cornell University are required to speak directly to an instructor in what he calls an oral defense. It's a testing method as old as Socrates and making a comeback. In the AI age, a growing number of college professors say they are turning to oral exams to help address a crisis in higher education. You won't be able to AI your way through an oral exam, says Schaefer, who introduced the oral defense last semester. Educators are no longer naively wondering if students will use generative AI to do their homework for them. A big question now is how to determine what students are actually learning. College instructors across the U.S. are noticing troubling new trends as generative artificial intelligence becomes more sophisticated. Take-home essays and other written assignments are coming back perfect, but when students are asked to explain their work, they can't. The long-term impact of AI use on critical thinking remains to be seen, but educators worry students increasingly see the hard work of thinking as optional. At the University of Pennsylvania, Emily Hammer, an associate professor of Middle Eastern languages and cultures, now pairs oral exams with written papers in her seminar classes. It comes across as if we're trying to prevent cheating, Hammer says. That's not why we're doing this. We're doing this because students are actually losing skills, losing cognitive capacity and creativity. Hammer forbids AI use on all writing assignments, but tells her class she knows she can't enforce that. However, if they haven't written the papers themselves, defending the material face-to-face will likely be a very stressful situation. Oral exams are not traditionally part of the modern American undergraduate system, unlike certain European universities. For instance, in the Oxbridge tutorial system in England, students meet faculty for weekly discussions. Some U.S. colleges saw a move toward oral exams during the COVID-19 pandemic to address concerns about online cheating, and interest has intensified since the launch of ChatGPT in 2022. During the pandemic, engineering professor Huihui Shui announced or launched a three-year study at the University of California, San Diego on how to scale oral exams. Several universities have since invited her to provide faculty workshops or discuss her research. At New York University, several types of oral assessments are on the rise. More faculty are requiring office hours, assigning presentations, and cold calling on students in class. Instructors are saying, "I need to look my students in the eye and ask, do you know this material?" says Clay Shirky, Vice Provost for AI and Technology in Education. One NYU professor has put a modern spin on the traditional oral test. Panos Ipirotis, a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business, unveiled an AI-powered oral exam last semester for the final exam in a class on AI product management. He calls it Fighting Fire with Fire. Students log in from home at any time that fits their schedule. A voice cloned from a business school professor greets them. The chatbot starts with questions about a final group project and drills into details based on each student's answers. "We wanted to check. Do you know what your team did? Were you a free rider? Did you outsource everything to AI?" says Ipirotis, who designed the tool with 11 Labs, a company that develops generative AI voice agents to conduct job interviews. Students in the class this semester are redesigning the AI agent to smooth out some kinks, and Ipirotis plans to use it in all his future classes. Feedback from students last semester was mixed. Business major Andrea Liu found the chatbot's voice to be surprisingly human, but the conversation felt choppy with odd pauses. However, she agreed with worried educators, "There is no perfect world here where AI exists and kids are not abusing it." Across the humanities and STEM disciplines, educators worry that students who skip the mental struggle necessary for problem solving won't develop the skills they need to advance in upper-level classes and careers. That's why Schaefer, the Cornell professor, introduced the oral defense in his biomedical engineering class. He requires students to sign up for 20-minute sessions of the Socratic-style questioning after submitting written problem sets, which are assigned several times each semester. With a class of 70 students, Schaefer splits the job with his teaching assistants. They no longer grade the written problem sets, just the oral defenses. He calls it incentivizing his students to do the work, or at least understand it enough to explain. Skeptics point out oral exams can be unsettling for students who are shy or have serious anxiety, but clarifying the format ahead of time and starting with softball questions can help, says Carolyn Aslan, who leads Cornell's oral exam training. Sometimes it's actually good to get that quiet student one-on-one, and you finally get to hear from them. Sometimes that is the breakthrough, Aslan says. Several of Schaefer's students said they felt nervous at first, but ended up preferring the oral exam. "I honestly liked it a lot," says Cornell junior Olivia Pichea, a biomedical engineering major. She initially found the oral defense nerve-wracking, but came to value the one-on-one time with the instructors. It kept her from feeling lost in a large class and helped her build the skill of articulating her technical knowledge that she would need to do in a job. "Having that live check-in holds you accountable," says Pichera. "It's a lot harder to look people in the eyes and say out loud, 'I don't know this,' and that makes you realize I should study this." Well, and with that, that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald interview for Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.